You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 17th of June 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
If we truly want to honour Jo, then what we should do is recognise that her values, service, community, tolerance, the values she lived by and worked by, those are the values that we need to redouble in our national life in the months and in the years to come.
The UK's Prime Minister leads tributes to murdered MP Jo Cox as all referendum campaigning is suspended. But will it and should it be any different once it resumes? My guests Isabel Hilton and James Rogers will be discussing that and the day's other big stories, including dissent over Syria policy at the US State Department, where dozens of diplomats sign a letter urging military action against Assad, and Russia's rapidly receding hopes of going to Rio. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to the show. My guests today are Isabel Hilton and James Rogers. Welcome both, as usual. The UK's EU referendum debate, which had been growing ever more foolish and rancorous in the build-up to next Thursday's vote, has fallen silent today, if for the most dreadful reasons imaginable. Both the Leave and Remain camps have suspended campaigning following yesterday's murder of Jo Cox, the Labour MP for Batley and Spen. The Prime Minister, Leader of the Opposition and Speaker of the House have visited her constituency today. Isabel, first of all, campaigning in theory will resume tomorrow. How different do you think the tone is likely to be?
Well, that's hard to say. I certainly think it should be different, because whatever the state of mind and motives of this individual, this man who murdered Jo Cox, the fact is that the deterioration of public discourse over the last 6 months in Britain has been profoundly depressing. And I think it is an enabling environment. If you encourage people to be frightened, to regard outsiders, to regard foreigners as a threat, to feel that everything is being stolen from them, you can't then be surprised if a deranged individual uses that as a motive to attack an MP. And I think it's absolutely disgraceful. I've never been more depressed about the state of this country as I am today.
James, Isabel's quite correct, I think, in suggesting that the tone of public discourse in this country, and I guess you could say in the United States as well, in fact, across Europe, has deteriorated noticeably in the last few years. But even when you could argue political discourse was conducted in a more civilized tone, terrible things did still happen. You know, people who, for whatever reason, whether motivated by extreme ideology and or some sort of mental illness, did do terrible things. Is this, where do you think there is a link, I guess, that is the link Isabel was discussing between the tone of this referendum and what happened yesterday?
Obviously, it's difficult to establish that beyond reasonable doubt, but it is absolutely true to say that we have a fairly confrontational political culture in this country to a large extent. Comparisons often made with the more civilized semicircular parliaments in other parts of the world, and our parliament is lined up with people opposite each other, frequently shouting at each other to the entertainment or bemusement of other parts of the world. But I would wholeheartedly agree with Isabel that it has definitely deteriorated in the last few months. It's more poisonous and divisive than ever I can remember. And so, but our political life, for all that, is blissful. Our political life is blissfully free generally of acts of extreme violence. And I think that's why this has been so very shocking, and I think that's why many people are making the link between what happened yesterday and the tone of the campaign before the EU referendum. The Guardian newspaper, in its main editorial today, for example, one of the main liberal voices in our few liberal voices, in fact, in our printed press in this country, did link mentioned in the same editorial the murder of Jo Cox and the poster used by some of the out campaigners, which has been variously criticised as downright racist or at least in very poor taste, which they used yesterday. And The Guardian didn't fight shy of making that link. So I think in that sense, as I say, it's hard to establish this precisely, but certainly I don't remember the atmosphere ever being this poisonous or divisive.
Isabel, among the formal recognitions of this event, the Conservatives, the Liberal Democrats and UKIP have all confirmed that they won't contest the by-election, which I guess seems like not just the right, but the only thing you can do. It's really hard to imagine how anybody could summon up the enthusiasm to campaign for the seat. They're recalling Parliament on Monday. Do these gestures... do they help at all, or is this just, I guess, that human urge from which politicians are not immune to, you know, to do something, even when there's really not all that much to be done?
Well, there's clearly nothing is going to bring Joe Cox back, but I think if the country didn't take it, and if politics didn't take it profoundly seriously, it would be even worse. I mean, this merits a recall of Parliament. It merits almost, you know, any political act you can think of to say this really matters and this is truly abhorrent. I thought one of the more interesting commentaries on this event was actually in The Spectator, which is both right-wing and for leave, by Alex Massey, who pointed out that one of the reasons things are so poisonous around a referendum is that this is an absolute once-and-for-all decision, whereas in a general election, things get nasty, but you're voting for, you know, one constituency MP, and you can throw them out at the next election.
And we can have another crack in 5 years if we don't win.
Precisely. Yeah. Things can change, whereas so much hangs on this one, 24-hour poll that it is truly... truly terrible moment and a very... I always thought this referendum was a reckless gamble to solve a minor problem and has created multiple crises, and everything that happens simply confirms my view of that. But it does go some way to explaining the nastiness and bitterness of this.
James, journalism is your field. What have you made of the coverage? There has been the expected row, I guess, a compare and contrast people have made between the way the media reacted to the stabbing at Leytonstone tube station last December, an event I missed by about 30 seconds. It's my local tube. I was walking towards it at the time, by a man who claimed to be acting in some level or another on behalf of Syria. He was immediately described as a terrorist with Islamist sympathies. He has since been convicted of attempted murder, but it does seem also quite clear that he was clearly extremely disturbed. Whereas in this case, the people weren't sure what to think. I think it was fairly clear from the off that the man under arrest, at least, is a middle-aged white male who does not appear to have been acting from any sort of religious belief, certainly. And the narrative that has been wheeled up has been the cut-and-paste loner kept himself to himself, etc., etc., although we are learning in recent hours that he's sort of had a fairly hefty collection of unsavoury literature.
Yes. I mean, but the terrorist word has certainly not been used to the extent that it might have been, and some critical voices have pointed that out. For example, for the Leytonstone attack, this was immediately linked somehow to wider terrorist problems elsewhere in the world, in the Middle East in particular, whereas the same links haven't quite been made here. All that said, if indeed the links to extreme right-wing groups are proved, and of course this is nothing more than media speculation, I have no more idea inside track on this than what I've read in the press myself, then clearly this also would be an act of terrorism if in any way he is linked to that. But that hasn't been really used so far. I was struck by one of the red top tabloids here, and its front page lead this morning, using the phrase Brexit gunman, explicitly linking this act of violence to the referendum campaign. That was in the Daily Star. Others, though, the more right-leaning newspapers which have come out in favour of the countries leaving the European Union, have tended to stress the sort of loner. In other words, not part of a wider movement in any way, so separate from politics. But as I say, critical voices are saying, well, hang on a minute. If this had been a Muslim man who had acted in this way and committed this act of violence, the press would be more likely to link it to a wider Islamist movement.
It is a weird binary thing, though, isn't it? Because it's far from unusual, I think, for someone to be both a politically motivated terrorist and mentally ill. You can be both at once.
You certainly can. I mean, it must help to some degree.
Isabel, there was a story I wrote, not wrote rather, a story I read in the Wall Street Journal earlier, and it was written by a journalist apologising for the fact that it had even occurred to him. But I don't know either who the people are who react to a moment like this by sort of picking up phones and yelling buy and sell, but it was noticeable that upon the news yesterday, both sterling and shares rose, gold dropped, the suggestion being that the market, in the amoral judgment of the markets, this somehow makes a Remain vote more likely than it might have been otherwise. Is there... There will be conversations being had by both camps about what, if anything, they can say about this between now and Thursday. Is there any way at all you can engage with something like this politically without looking like the worst kind of vulture, or are they just going to have to let people make up their own minds?
I would go for letting people make up their own minds at this point. I was trying to think yesterday, actually, of what you could possibly say if you were a politician on the Remain side that would not look awful. You know, it's very, very difficult to try to... I mean, whatever you do, you'll be accused of making political capital out of this appalling event. And I think probably rightly. I think it's one of those moments when you simply have to let the event speak for itself. And you're not going to change the minds of the people who are determined to vote out, whose emotions are committed, who will simply say this man was a madman and nothing to do with us. I don't think you're going to change their minds in any event. So simply best to stay silent on that.
James, as well, another journalistic angle, or at least it involves journalism. A lot of people have suggested, in terms of the culture that now surrounds politics, that we have become, I think, I mean, the British, and I say this as an outsider to this country, I think are generally quite healthily sceptical of their political masters. But that has become noticeably ever more toxic and contemptuous. There is a widespread, I think, assumption, and it's amplified by social media as everything is, that they're all crooks and swindlers out for themselves, which is generally not the case. I mean, have we become too lazily contemptuous of people who do things like run for parliament or serve on local councils, most of which are terrible jobs in which you basically get blamed for absolutely everything, often for things you can't actually do anything about, to the sort of complete destruction of any sense of sane personal life?
I mean, it's interesting, in the last 24 hours or so, a number of other members of parliament have come out and talked about the threats which they've suffered. And of course, on social media, one can never tell whether those threats of violence are likely to be followed through.
Well, there have been in recent years. Stephen Timms, the MP for East Ham, was stabbed at a constituency surgery in 2011. Nigel Jones was stabbed and his aide was killed in 2000 in similar circumstances.
Yeah, I mean, and I think in terms of the sort of threats of violence and the way that people see things on social media, I think it is a great concern. I mean, the thing that's overshadowing a lot of this cynicism was a story which actually dominated the general election before last in this country, which was the revelation by the Daily Telegraph newspaper that a lot of MPs have been systematically abusing their expenses. And that, I think, that coming just 2 years after the financial crisis, when public sector workers were looking at no pay rise for the foreseeable future, other people had lost their jobs, did not help to nurture a culture in which politicians were respected. I mean, one can only hope that the pause in the campaign will lead to it becoming a little more measured than it has been up until now, if indeed. And I think perhaps that was part of the motivation for the sides deciding to suspend the campaign for 24 hours. But I think it is a great deal of concern, and I can see why a lot of MPs probably don't particularly feel appreciated, but would never dare say so.
I mean, Isabel, is there there's a chicken, egg, cart, horse question here, and I generally where issues of how the media regards a subject are concerned, I tend to look at the demand rather than the supply, or blame the demand rather than the supplier. I always thought that, for example, the Leveson inquiry should have put a tabloid reader on the stand and said to them, why are you paying money to read this crap? You are the reason.
Fair point.
You are the reason that this culture exists. But is there a problem with them? Because, I'll rewind a bit. A reaction I saw a lot of on social media yesterday was from people saying, I'd never heard of Jo Cox. She sounds like she was marvellous. Is there a problem that MPs like Jo Cox, who, whether you agreed with her or not about things, was clearly a diligent, hardworking constituency MP who took her job extremely seriously, they tend not to appear on the news. They don't get on the panel shows. They're not forever you know, seeking to attract attention to themselves. Does the media rather lazily fall into paying attention, I guess, to the ones with the loudest mouths?
Well, I think that, again, the last year has been an absolute demonstration of that. You know, Nigel Farage is constantly on the radio. Donald Trump didn't even have to spend anything to get on television. So there is this sort of clickbait, you know, viewer hungry, the loudest person seems to attract the most attention, so stick him on, regardless of whether it's doing politics a service. But I think there's also, you know, there is a more profound problem in politics in the last, well, really since globalization, since Thatcher, that, you know, who speaks for those people who have lost? And as we now see, they are voting in ways that are pretty uncomfortable for a lot of us, because they can't find anyone else who they do feel represents them. And I think that is a serious problem of elite politics, that we have a system which has hugely benefited a very small number of people, and the rest are just supposed to put up with it. Well, comes a point when they don't.
Yeah, and in this country, it's further compounded by our rather antiquated first-past-the-post electoral system, which saw the UK Independence Party garner some 4 million votes in last year's general election and get one seat in Parliament.
Yeah, I think under proportional representation, they would have 80-odd MPs.
Yeah, depending on where the threshold lay, but they would. They have substantially more than they do. And, of course, many of those people who voted for them, one imagines, if not all of them, although I did see one opinion poll, one survey, which said that there were 3% of supporters of that party who intended to vote Remain, which I found was rather odd. But I imagine most of them...
You were dazed and confused.
I read the same poll and remember thinking, I can't decide whether I'd really be interested to meet one of those people or whether I really don't want to meet one of those people.
But, you know, one imagines they will almost all be voting for the UK to leave the European Union, one way in which they can almost certainly get their voice heard.
OK, well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Miller, along with Isabel Hilton and James Rogers. Coming up next, Big Trouble in Foggy Bottom.
Whether you're thinking of founding your own nation or would like to make the one you live in a bit better, we have the book for you. The brand new How to Make a Nation, A Monocle Guide, is an informed and quietly provocative book about updating the art of statecraft. After 10 years of meeting inspiring citizens and on-it PMs, soft power influencers and smart architects, we'll tell you how to construct the perfect embassy, design a modern parliament, and even how to make the most of your national dress. This 340-page, large-format book delivers fresh thinking and lots of solutions too. It's a book about the small things that can make our nations work better for everyone that calls them home. Buy your copy today at monocle.com and all good bookstores. Go on, be the leader.
You are listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Isabel Hilton and James Rogers. Now, it's difficult to imagine that there is a single policymaker anywhere in the Western world who regards Western policy towards Syria as having been an outstanding success. However, few participants or observers have advanced any better ideas. That appears to have changed, at least judging by the leak of an internal State Department memo signed by more than 50 senior and seniorish diplomats who suggest, see if you can guess, launching airstrikes against targets associated with the Assad regime. Isabel, are we talking about here the proverbial owners of a hammer to whom everything resembles a nail?
Begins to look like it, actually. I mean, the dazzling success of such interventions in recent years. I know there's a huge frustration about Western policy or you know, the relative inaction of the United States and Syria, and it is an awful situation. But it's not clear to me what precisely is being advocated here that would help. What is, you know, what the long-term goal is? At the moment, we've got Russians intervening on behalf of Assad. Are we really proposing to intervene, you know, on the other side militarily? And isn't that pretty dangerous? And who are the good guys? I mean, that is one of the problems in Syria, that there has been this abiding Western myth that there is a so-called moderate opposition that would magically step forward. We've heard this before. We heard this in other situations. We heard it in Iraq. And I'm not convinced by it. So although I completely recognize the frustration and I think share it. But I'm not sure that this is really going to advance or would advance were it to be adopted, which, of course, it's not going to be.
It does seem to me, certainly, as a plan to have what could possibly go wrong written all over it. James, apart from one can imagine at this point a certain visceral satisfaction in blowing up a few things belonging to President Bashar al-Assad, would bombing Assad-related targets actually do any good?
It's difficult to say. I mean, you could perhaps see this as a counter move to the fact that Russia made their move last year and earlier this year. Really moving then into a diplomatic and military policy vacuum and saying, well, if nobody else has got an idea, we do at least have an idea. And they would argue have achieved their aims such as they were. And perhaps the United States feels that the way that things have gone has left Mr. Assad looking reasonably secure. He's never looked totally insecure, probably from the first year and a half of the uprising against him. But it's difficult to see really where this would go. And it would have the added complication of possible confrontation with Russia, which, you know, came close, of course, when Russia and the United States were both planning to carry out airstrikes on targets in Syria. But it's just it's difficult to see really where this goes. I mean, I think perhaps it's more interesting in some ways in the timing of the presidential election and that the foreign policy establishment is trying to get its voice heard. Mr. Obama presumably not particularly interested in acting in those months which remain in office, given his reluctance to do so thus far, and perhaps seeking to offer advice to the incoming president, whoever they may be, before he or she takes office.
Isabel, as James points out, President Barack Obama's policy towards Syria has been as far as he decently can to stay out of it. That being the case, and as James also points out, that being exceedingly unlikely to change between now and January, unless he really feels like, I guess, tossing a hospital pass to his successor. Why would this memo have been written, circulated, signed, and then leaked?
Well, there is a mechanism in the State Department for the expression of dissenting opinion, and it's a healthy mechanism. It allows officials who might feel that things have gone horribly wrong, though clearly it didn't work in the Bush regime when officials felt things were going pretty horribly wrong before the invasion of Iraq. It was set up, as I understand it, during the Vietnam War, where again you have a hugely contentious nationally contentious policy, and some officials who felt that there was another way, and a channel was set up to allow the expression of those views, which I think is a pretty healthy thing. Why it should be leaked now, and indeed, you know, there are. It's a lot of people who signed it. It's some 51 people who signed it, which sounds like a lot. Until you see at what level and who they are, it's very hard to gauge, you know, how representative this is, a State Department opinion. In any event, there's, and often has been, a difference of view between State Department and other departments of government, so Department of Defense in particular, and in this case, the White House. These are well-established fault lines in U.S. foreign policy, which tend to emerge at moments of crisis. Tactically, if this is being leaked tactically, I agree with James that the eye always has to be on the next presidency, on the incoming president, whoever she may be, with a view perhaps to moving things along.
Okay, well, finally tonight, it does rather look like the Rio Olympic Orchestra, if there even is such a thing, can dispense with any further rehearsals of the Russian national anthem. The suspension, which bans all Russian athletes from international competition over allegations of state-sponsored doping, has been upheld by the International Association of Athletics Federations. James, we'll come back to whether there might be a way through this via the IOC shortly, but just while we've been on air, the IAAF are saying there might be some way through for Russian athletes not competing through the Russian system. What do they mean by that, and how is that going to work?
Well, presumably it means them, in effect, competing as individuals. I suppose we'd have to see how that, in the way that stateless people have been able to do in the past, I suppose, if Russia as a nation is banned. I mean, it really goes to the heart of course, as to whether this was a systematic program, whether the National Sporting Administration was involved or not, or if so, the extent to which it was involved. Presumably, The governing body is fairly convinced that it is so widespread that they had no choice but to retain the ban. But banning a big country like Russia from an Olympic Games is a pretty drastic option, and will no doubt probably have political repercussions too, given that large parts of the Russian political establishment and popular opinion seem to believe at the moment the entire world is against them. This will do nothing to dissuade them of that sort of impression.
It is very, very difficult indeed to imagine RT and other broadcasters saying that Russia has been quite properly barred from competition at the Olympic Games. It's a fair cop.
That is an unlikely
outcome. Entirely our fault. We're dreadfully sorry. That does seem unlikely. Isabel, the IOC can still decide to let Russia compete. They are deciding in Lausanne on Tuesday. IOC Vice President John Coates has said today that Russian athletics were rotten to the core. So I think there's one vote there. One vote there they're not going to get. Should the IOC let Russia compete?
Well, I think not. Look, it's taken years for the World Anti-Doping Agency to summon the courage to do something about this. There have been whistleblowers falling out of every tree, including Russian athletes who've described in detail being obliged by the state system to participate in doping. And the World Anti-Doping Agency has looked steadfastly at their feet, except occasionally to toss one of these whistleblowers into the jaws of the Russian Olympic Committee, who are presumably complicit. So, they really have tried very hard to do nothing for a very long time. So the fact that they are finally doing something, I think, means that there really is no way out. And to pull the plug on them now would simply, confirm everybody's view of the whole system is rotten from top to bottom.
I mean, James, what impact would it have on Russia itself, I guess? I mean, how could they respond to this? Can they hold their own Olympics, inviting teams from Abkhazia, South Ossetia, occupied Ukraine? This is pariah nation stuff we're talking about.
I would imagine it's deeply worrying as well. I mean, let's look at the last few years and look at the way in which Russia has really tried extremely hard as part of its campaign to take a larger role on the world stage. Sport has been a very important part of that. Look at the money and the effort that went into hosting the 2014 Winter Olympics in Sochi. Look at the money and the effort that went into getting the 2018 World Cup as well. I was a correspondent in Moscow at the time of the 2008 Champions League final, and I was astonished by the cooperation which was offered by normally terse and impolite, to put it mildly, Russian police officers. And they really had been put on a charm offensive. They allowed visa-free travel, all this to try on this. And now, if this is going to start going wrong, it's not going to look good for Russia.
Yeah, but isn't it part of the problem that when sport is a state project, exactly as you described, that's when, I mean, after all, it was a state project in East Germany, and the East Germans were notorious for doping. Yeah. When it became a state project in China, I seem to recall the entire women's swimming team had to be removed from the pool. So it is this, this combination of the projection of state power and sport which creates this kind of...
And at that point, one begins to feel a bit sorry for the athletes, because one imagines that they probably didn't have a great deal of choice in some cases.
Well, that's what the whistleblowers were saying.
But Isabel, on that thought, as a China specialist that you are, does success at an Olympic Games, is it still regarded, at least by China, like by Russia, as being important a demonstration of their ideological prowess as it was during the Cold War era?
Certainly. Well, it's a demonstration of national pride, and that morphs into the same thing. Mm-hmm. Our great nation, even if people are united against us, we've beaten them on the sporting field. This is a vindication of our system, our power. We make the people feel good. In a country where maybe people don't feel so good about the political system, it's a very important symbolic moment.
We will have to leave it there. Isabel Hilton of China Dialogue, James Rogers of City University, thanks both very much for joining us. That is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Today's show was produced by Daniel Giacopelli, researched by Gaia Lutz and Alice Tennant. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. The studio manager was, in fact, Chris Chilvers. I note now, looking through the production booth glass, I'm just reading out what's put in front of me. And there's more on the day's main story on the Monocle Daily at 2200. I blame the producer. Midori House returns on Monday at the same time, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend.